Hi, this is Steve Kopfus, and I'm here to interview Paul Meyer, founder and president of Friends of Gone Road. It's a Minneapolis-based nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide education and support to for Nairobi, Kenya children living in poverty, whose families are affected by HIV/AIDS, so they can transform their lives. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you.
Notably, this organization was formed in 2006. It's served more than 350 children. Those children live in poverty in some of the most challenging conditions. You know, when you think about the situation they come from, it's a little bit hard to even grasp unless you actually have been there. I know I've been there. This will be my fourth trip coming up for this project. And Paula, you can talk about how many times you've been there, but these kids come from broken families. They live in poverty. They live in places where there's often no plumbing, there's no fresh water, there's no sanitation. You know, you see women going on Saturdays and getting water for their washing and other needs. There's limited electricity. Sometimes there's a battery, and the streets are basically unpaved and rutted, and sometimes really muddy and really hard to get around. And I've always kind of likened it to, like, here we are, we're sitting right now in Minneapolis, and we've got, you know, about over 2 million people in Minneapolis, and Nairobi's similar size. But I think about the, you know, the city is, the urban area is still, you know, it's fairly modern, if you want to call it that. It has skyscrapers and, you know, there's businesses and banks and finance and education and things like that. But if you go beyond, if you were in Minneapolis, kind of in the southwest corner of the metropolitan area, it'd be like a Chaska or Chanhassen. Just imagine maybe 1 million people living there in these kind of conditions. And a lot of that was a result of a lot of mass immigration from worse situations. People were immigrating from the rural areas where there was little food and there was starvation and a lot of struggles. And they came to the city, and the Kenyan or the Nairobi, basically the local governance, said, well, we're just not going to really acknowledge you, so we're not going to set up any infrastructure. So here are these, in a sense, squatter tenants have been kind of piled into a small area. And again, it's hard to imagine unless you've been there. So it's very enlightening and humbling. And you know, this is a little bit of story trying to help people understand that.
In one of the things I've learned in the 10 or 11 years that I've been doing this work is that about a third of the population of the planet lives in conditions that the United Nations describes as slums. And their definition of slums is houses are built on land that is not owned. There's no running water. There's no electricity. It's usually very, very crowded. And that is exactly the situation that the families in this program live in. And so, yes, there are more than 1 million people. According to the United Nations, about 65% of the population of Nairobi lives in slum conditions. But about 2 billion people on the planet live in these kinds of conditions, which when we're sitting in beautiful, clean Minneapolis is hard to contemplate.
2 billion. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, so this isn't just an outlier here. It's a significant part of the world, and it shows how fortunate we are, but also we all have different realities, don't we?
Exactly right.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking a little bit about the realities in Nairobi, and specifically in the slums. And one of the things I want to kind of focus on is kind of take a little bit of a historical perspective, because you've been doing this for, you know, more than a decade now, and we have a purpose of kind of talking about some of the programs that kind of bring us to this podcast. But contextually or historically, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you kind of got to here. We're talking about needs for water, we have health issues, we have all these conditions that qualify it for being from the United Nations as being the substandard locations. How did you come to the mission that was focused on education?
It is a global truth that the way people improve their lives after the most basic needs are met is by getting an education. And certainly I've had that experience in my life. And I think many, many people in the United States can relate to the notion that education gave them opportunities that gave them a richer life as they grew. And so in Kenya, what I came to learn before we started the organization was that many, many children in the slums were not able to go to even primary school because their parents couldn't afford school fees or uniforms. And, you know, the all-in cost for a year of school fees and uniforms is about $500. And it just seemed to me preposterous that, you know, that you would have children who didn't ask to be born but have no chance to get even to get to literacy. And so I guess it's a profound personal belief in the power of education, my own personal experience with the transformative power of education in my life, that led me to believe that this is just a wrong that can be righted for some number of kids.
So when you use the word transform lives, I'm wondering if you can talk about that. What does that mean, and kind of how did you arrive at that as kind of the pivot that you see, or the value that you can help to deliver?
We define a life transformed as a child from poverty getting enough education that they are able to get a job in the formal Kenyan economy. So we have a very specific definition. There are definitely transformative and formative experiences that happen along the way for these children, but our definition of a life transformed and of mission success is when a kid who comes from the slums gets a job. And it's a job that will allow them to support themselves and by extension to help their families. In 2007, we were having a board strategic planning session, and we put ourselves to the question of, do we want to go for quality or do we want to go for quantity? So if our focus was on quantity, we probably would have stayed with just primary education and recruited kids, got them through eighth grade, and then had them finish the program, which many programs do in Kenya. But we decided that if we were going to invest in these kids, we wanted to invest in them for the long term. So most of our kids come in the program in second or third grade, and we stick with them through primary school, which in Kenya is eighth grade, through high school, which is 4 years as it is here, and then in almost all cases through one or two years of post-secondary education, with the goal of our helping them actually get employment. And so we believe that if we're going to make these investments, let's do it longitudinally, let's invest deeply in these kids, and let's see if we can help them transform their lives.
So when you talk about kind of the end goal of, let's call it employment, are you taking a perspective that we need to, in a sense, train the kids? I mean, that, you know, there's certain jobs that are give kids the ability to, you know, get a job because, you know, that job is right there and they can easily attain it. But I guess I'm wondering, you know, there's been kind of different talks about, you know, the future, and maybe Kenya isn't there yet, but are we educating kids really for occupations, or are you thinking about how to learn or how to think and how to solve problems and things like that? I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about that.
The Kenyan educational system is a memorize for the test kind of a system. Our mission isn't to change the Kenyan educational system. Our mission is to educate children in their system. And there are those who tackle the Kenyan educational system and its effectiveness. We are not among those. We go with the educational system that exists. When kids finish high school, as is true here, some students have been strong academically and they are inclined to move into some kind of post-secondary education, doing subjects like accounting or, you know, subjects that are a little more academic. And some students are better suited for customer service or being a being an electrician, and we try to help them discern both what their strengths are, and we discourage them from pursuing careers where we think it's going to be hard for them to get employment. So, you know, the related question is something that we're just now beginning to work on, and that is what I would call, or what we are calling, soft skills. So as we raise our children all throughout their lives, they are getting exposed to ideas like, when you meet somebody new, you shake their hand and you look them in the eye. They're getting exposed to feedback from their parents about what is effective and what is ineffective, what they're good at, what they're not good at. And certainly in the American school system, a lot of emphasis on thinking skills, problem-solving skills. Those kinds of inputs are really substantially not there for the students from this program. And we're working now to try to close that gap because it gets in the way of their ability to get a job ultimately. I mean, that we really do try in our program to not let the scope creep too much. I mean, if our mission is to help kids get an education so they can transform their lives, let's stay tight on that. But we find as they get to be 19, 20 years old, and they don't have enough self-awareness or self-confidence to really approach a prospective employer effectively, we really need to work on closing that gap. And we're starting to work on that now.
So maybe for clarification, because everyone who might be listening to this podcast may have differing levels of understanding of the organization. And so maybe just for clarification for those who are not so close, I'm wondering if you can explain, well, do you run your own schools? When you talk about programs, what does that actually mean? And how are you able to implement that or have those values, the value of what the support of the organization does in that context?
When we started this organization, another very early principle that we decided on is that we didn't want to invest any donor money in what I would call capital investments. So we didn't want to build schools. We didn't want to build orphanages. We wanted to leverage existing infrastructure. And, you know, about half of the kids in this program are orphans. The other half live with an HIV positive parent. And those who are orphans, we always seek to identify surviving family members who will have them in their home. When a student enters our program, they are required to attend schools that we select. So there are lots and lots of schools in Kenya at the primary level. Some of them are private, some of them are public. Our philosophy is to send students to private school during primary. And it's kind of a perverse rationale, so I'd like to explain it. In 2004, Kenya implemented universal primary education. So the Kenyan government says any kid that wants to go to primary school can go. And so you would think all of these poor kids would just be able to go to a public school and it would be just fine. But it's an unfunded mandate, which governments do sometimes. And so what that means is that public schools at the elementary level in Kenya are overcrowded. There could be 100 kids in a classroom. There could be one teacher. The teachers are so demoralized that they come late. Kids that don't have uniforms, they allow them to stay till 10 in the morning, 11 in the morning, then they chase them home. So it's a very bad learning environment. So we select private primary schools that have a good track record of academic outcomes. And all the academic outcomes in Kenya are measured by a standardized exam that's administered each year. So we can evaluate the schools in our service area that have done a good job. And we have two or three primary schools that we work with. So when a kid joins our program, they are already in school. They're in second or third grade. We require that they leave the school that they're in and come to one of the schools that we select because we know our schools do a good job and because we have 150 kids in primary school at any given time, and we visit the schools once or twice each school term, and this allows us to monitor the performance of the kids, to have a good working relationship with the school administration, and to manage that many kids going through a program. At the secondary level, it's a little harder because Kenya does not have universal secondary education. So the best high schools in Kenya actually are sponsored by the national government. And the next best are sponsored by their provincial governments, and the next best are sponsored by the local districts. And then private high schools are the worst high schools in Kenya. So we, at the secondary level, try to get them into national, provincial, and district schools to the extent that their scores allow it. But if all the kids that finished eighth grade last year were to be in high school this year, Kenya would have to have built classroom capacity of 200,000 more seats. So they are far from having the capacity at the secondary school level for every kid that finishes eighth grade to go. And it's also expensive. Most kids in Kenya, when they go to high school, it's boarding school. And so it's not expensive like we think of boarding school, but it costs a family approximately $1,500 a year to send their kid to boarding school. And that's just out of reach for most people.
So you talked a little bit about the scope and kind of working within the existing educational structure. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the scale and talk about both geography, but also the sense of how many kids can you serve. And I was talking with a friend about this recently, and the question came up, well, what if one of the students who gets into the program has siblings, and how does that work? If other siblings, do they get some kind of access as well, or how does that, is there some kind of weird alienation that happens? Oh, you get to go to school and I don't, or because you're in school, I do get to go to school. And how, so scale, I'm sure, is an important part, because you want to manage how many. Well, you have to manage it, because we're going to talk about this later, kind of the relationship between the sponsors and the actual students. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the scale and how you've kind of managed that and how that's worked.
So we concentrate in one local geography, and it's called the Dagoretti slums of Nairobi. And there are a bunch of little sub-villages in that area, but all the kids in our program have to come from that area. And it's really for logistical reasons, because we have these two or three schools that we work with, and they are in that geography. And every Saturday, we expect the kids to come to the Saturday program. And that's a big open field that's in walking distance of this geography. And so that's just a requirement of the program, that kids have to live in that geography. The program has actually, up to now, it's supported about 500 kids. 500 kids have been in the program, and some number are now alumni, and some number dropped out along the way. But we have served about 500 kids, and I think that over the course of a decade, if we wanted to grow this organization, what we would need to do is create another location, because it is physically challenging to support and to bring together more than 500 kids at a time or 400 kids at a time. It's just physically hard to do it. It's hard to feed that many children. So that's, as we begin to grow the organization or scale the organization, I would envision that we would replicate this. So we would create some central administrative spine that handles things like finance and HR and procurement and technology, and then have centers where some number of children and hopefully a growing number of children are served. In some ways, I think of our first 10 years as almost being a pilot project, where we were asking the question, can we really choose children from this most impoverished environment almost in the world and stand with them for a decade and get them to the point that they can get through the educational system and transform their own lives? And increasingly, it's pretty clear to me that the answer to that question is yes, we can.
And so what about that question about
the siblings?
The siblings, yeah, how does that work?
We have evolved our answer to that over time. For a period of time, we accepted as many as three kids in one family. We're now down to two. So if there's one child in the family, we will accept one more. And Kenyans that I know have told me regularly that they think that we should only take one child from each family. And their rationale is, if you choose the best one and they get through, they will help all the others. And, you know, when you meet professional Kenyans, I've never met a professional Kenyan who has a job in the formal economy who isn't supporting 8, 10, 12, 20 kids going through some primary, secondary, post-secondary education. So when Kenyans begin to earn money, they create their own small versions of this program. They support. I one time met a judge in Kenya, and she said, I do this for my home village. I'm sponsoring 80 children right now. So, I mean, it's a common thing. And so the Kenyans that argue you should just take one are basically saying that's the way to maximize impact.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, let's talk about how this works from the standpoint of the relationship between kind of what's happening here in Minneapolis and United States and actually several places around the world where you have sponsors, and kind of what that model is like and how you pair them up with students, because that seems like there were probably a lot of different options in terms of, you know, you look at world relief organizations and things like that. I mean, this model, I wonder if you can explain that a little bit and how that's kind of how you establish that.
The central idea in this model is that each kid, that we raise children one at a time. Each kid is different, they have different needs, and anyone who's been a parent knows that. And we have believed that it is far more meaningful for someone to actually deeply know a child and watch their development over time. And I think that that has been borne out over the last 10 years that we have done this, that when sponsors are connected to one child and they see their development over time, it's meaningful to them. And sometimes it's even transformative to them. But the way it plays out in Kenya in the implementation of the program is we have caseworkers that are paired with these kids and that stick with them through their whole 10 or 12 years in the program. And those caseworkers know the kids and develop a deep relationship with them. And we keep track of when those kids have to go to the doctor and what their school marks are and what kind of issues exist in their family situation that they're trying to cope with. So, and when they get done with high school, as we do here and as must be done, we try to help them understand who they are and help guide them about how to move into careers that will take advantage of the strengths that they bring to the world. So, I mean, I think the central defining principle is that you raise kids one at a time, and that it's a personal experience for sponsors, but it's also implemented in a personal way on the ground in Kenya.
So what you're saying is, maybe I'll be more explicit, an individual, sponsors a child.
Right. Okay. It's a one-on-one relationship, and their gifts mean that kid's life has the opportunity. I mean, their gift changes the trajectory of that kid's life. $750 a year, $2 a day, a latte a day. Oh, I guess lattes are more expensive than that now. Can change
the
trajectory.
Sponsor two kids.
You can sponsor two kids for a latte a day. That's exactly right.
So I'm wondering, then organizationally, how does that work? I mean, here you have sponsors that are throughout the U.S. and again abroad. Maybe you can just talk about the how far you reach, you know, in the world for sponsors. But so you have this Friends of Gung Road organization, but then how do you operationalize that in Nairobi? And what I'm really interested in, not only functionally, but almost like philosophically, how do you take the funds that are being generated by the sponsors, and then operationally implement that in a way that is meaningful. And here's maybe one of my caveats or my lens that I've seen, and it's a bothersome lens for me, is, you know, I've traveled now to Kenya a few times, and what I find is waiting at the airport terminal, where you have these groups of Westerners that are going to Kenya. Some of them are going for safari, but some are going for some kind of relief purpose. And they're all gathered together, and they're all feeling good about themselves, and they're going to go enlighten, you know, the Kenyans about, you know, how to be successful, or, you know, how to be, you know, better people, or how to be whatever it is. But there's this almost, I don't know, they always say when you volunteer, you get a lot back. But sometimes it feels like it's, well, even more selfish than that. You know, it's like people are going there almost like they have the answers. So I'm wondering if you can talk about how you've structured this and acknowledge some of those local differences or cultural components in implementing the programs that we're talking about.
It's a good question. Gong Road Children Association is the Kenyan organization. And Gong Road Children Association implements our programs on the ground in the slums of Nairobi. Friends of Gong Road is a U.S. 501c3, and we have our mission is primarily to fundraise and to communicate to supporters. And I would say that with respect to Gong Road Children Association, our relationship is primarily a strategic relationship. We have helped shape and devise the programs. We have created the reporting infrastructure that allows us to collect data about the effectiveness of our program. So we have trained people in Kenya who are our employees about some dimensions of how they do their job. But the structuring of the program has been a joint effort. And so, I mean, our program has three main components. The first is education. And we spend about 54-55% of our budget on education and all the things related to that. So that's uniforms, books, school supplies, school fees, all of that stuff. The second component of our program is what we call safety and well-being. And this evolved over time as we learned that if a kid is hungry, they don't do as well in school as if they've got a full stomach. So we feed them breakfast and lunch each school day when they're in primary school. And when they're in high school, they get all their meals at boarding school. We know that kids don't do as well in school if they can't see the chalkboard. And so we have all of our kids' eyes tested. And we support basic medical care. All of those programs are in safety and well-being. The third program, I think, is one of the things that has helped make us successful, and we call it supportive community. And what it means is that we have caseworkers assigned to each kid who keep track of that kid. We have the Saturday program, so we can feed them on Saturdays, but also check in with them on Saturdays. We have camp, we have a computer lab, we have a library. All of those things are kind of the surround sound that allows us to importantly help kids be successful. And when you talk to most graduates of this program, they believe that Gong Road Children Association is as close to being family for them as their own family. It's an extension of family. It's family that they may not have. And it has helped provide that kind of support that they need to be successful.
And so those things are provided basically year-round, with the exception of the camp program, which we're going to talk about more specifically.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. All of those services are provided year-round in a variety of different formats, intended, again, to support the education mission and to maximize the chances that a kid gets through the program.
So one thing I don't want to get too deep into, because I'm sure we could talk a lot more about it, but I'm wondering about that caseworker support. So is that where the caseworker knows the child? Because the child, in those situations, at least at the primary school level, would still be living at home. Is that correct?
Correct. At every level, they live at home. When they're in primary school, they live at home and walk to school and come home at night. When they're in secondary school, they go to boarding school and come home at school holidays. So they always have a home situation that they return to.
So the caseworkers, to what extent do they kind of understand the child's family background?
To a deep extent. They visit the home regularly, and it's different at a different tempo when they're in primary school versus secondary school. But they visit each home at least once or twice in the year. When families are having, when someone's HIV positive, they can get very sick, you know, unexpectedly, and be unable to work and unable to get food. And so we have the ability to provide family food aid, and the person that they call is their child's caseworker. The caseworker duties are to know the kid, to visit the home, to visit the school, and to collect the data that we need about how the child is doing, so that both we can communicate to the sponsor, but so that we can flag situations where children are at risk or things are deteriorating and we need to do a stronger intervention.
So one of the things that it seems that maybe it's not explicitly stated as kind of part of the mission, maybe a part of the outcomes of the transformative process, is kind of breaking that cycle, isn't it? I mean, these kids are coming from, let's call them unhealthy backgrounds, and they're being able to recognize perhaps that is not normal, that it's not healthy, it's not sustainable. You know, they're seeing people around them die, both parents in some situations, and living with extended families. And now, you know, it seems that there's got to be some impact. It's not like you're just, you know, having a student supported and then they're just going to go do the same thing and perpetuate the cultural problems that kind of really devastated this community. I mean, is that a simple assessment?
Right. I mean, our goal is that we break the cycle of poverty, and we believe the path to do that is that these students, I mean, for example, globally, to get a job in Nairobi, in any field almost, you have to know how to operate a computer. Well, these kids come from homes where there's no electricity. And the operative question every day is, are we going to have enough food to eat? So they're not going to get exposed to computers except through our computer lab. So through our computer lab and programs we have in place, they learn computer skills. And they get a certificate that says that they've accomplished certain things in computer skills. And with that and the other education that they get, they are much better equipped to get a job and pull themselves out of poverty. So when we find issues that are preventing our kids from being successful in the formal economy, we try to develop a program that will address it. Another program that we're just now working on implementing, we've had a sexual and reproductive health program for a long time, and it has been ineffective. And, you know, it's a global truth that adolescents become sexually active. And in Kenya, there is very little access to birth control. And there is a lot of education about AIDS and what causes AIDS and how to prevent AIDS. But nonetheless, we've had 15, maybe 17 girls in our program since inception get pregnant. And most of those girls have returned to poverty and the cycles that brought their parents into that situation. So teen pregnancy is a huge marker for poverty. And we are now planning to launch a new, much more active program that involves peer-to-peer counseling and that would support getting these girls access to contraception at a local clinic and so forth. So, I mean, we try programs, and if they aren't effective and it's getting in the way of our students being successful at transforming their lives, we tweak the programs and try to improve their effectiveness.
So, again, this is another topic that we could really delve into more as well, but maybe it's a good time to touch. It's this idea of kind of sustainability of the organization. I'm wondering, you know, if we could talk a little bit about Caribou Loo for a moment, because that seems to be kind of outside of the realm of kind of the execution side or the administration of of some of these services, but it's more of a business model or a method to create a sustainable organization. So I'm just wondering if we can touch on what is Caribou Lou and how is it brought into the equation and where do you see it going? But again, we could spend,
we could spend
2 hours
on that. Sustainability is a multifaceted challenge, and especially for founders. I mean, founders can get right in the way of all kinds of things that make organizations sustainable. And I'm working very hard on being a founder that's enabling sustainability. And so the three big things that I think are important are we need an economic model that does not rely 100% on U.S. philanthropy. And so far, through the first 11 years of operation of this organization, 98% of the money we spend in Kenya is raised in the United States. So we haven't achieved that goal yet. The primary device that we have established to try to tackle that goal is that we launched a business in Kenya. It is a for-profit business. It's a portable toilet business. I believe it will become profitable, and I believe that in the long run it will help provide a platform or a foundation of revenue in the form of profits from this business that will support the growth of Gong Road Children Association. So financial sustainability is one dimension. The other part of financial sustainability is that we have an endowment fund in the United States. And that endowment fund gives us degrees of freedom that we wouldn't have if we didn't have it. So the endowment fund today is about $650,000. We'd like to grow that to a couple million dollars. And again, primarily because it will help make the organization sustainable, it will also support innovation like creation of businesses like Caribou Lou. Part of how we funded Caribou Lou's launch is by taking distributions from that endowment fund. The third dimension of sustainability is you have to continually have new leaders and people in the organization. And, as much as, I'm in an aging cohort, and we're all in aging cohorts, but many, many of the most active people in this organization have been people in their 50s and 60s who have finished their full-time professional career and have many gifts to offer and have brought those gifts to bear in the form of talent. And you're a great example of someone who's done that. We have lots of people who've done that. We need to find more people like that, but they need to be younger because we're aging in place. So I think that is another important dimension of sustainability. So we're working on all three of those, on getting a financial foundation in Kenya that will emanate from a for-profit business, having a suitable size to our endowment fund so that we have degrees of freedom financially, and recruiting younger and talented people to be involved with the organization.
Interesting. So let's do a little bit more of the deep dive into kind of the topic area that we'll be following up with in some future podcasts, and that is with the CAMP program. And there's kind of the overview of what is the CAMP program, kind of what is its function, purpose, how has it been going, where do you see it going, but then also the idea of how that programming has evolved, and specifically kind of how you've kind of tapped some of these talents of volunteers and board members and people who have, have shown an interest in providing some of those new perspectives or resources or, did I say talents already? You said that. But so I'm wondering if we could talk about, so overall, how did the CAMP program begin? And the overview is there's the little kid program, there's a CAMP program.
It's a one-day.
It's a one-day thing, right? So it's kind of a nice little thing, the small scale there with the size of the kids. Then you've got the grammar camp, so it's kind of grammar school age kids. And then you've got the senior camp, so those are more of teens and kids that are kind of reaching level of maturity. And then there's the leadership camp. So I'm wondering, first of all, if you can talk a little bit about, this sounds like it's part of that supportive community.
Yes.
And it sounds like, and my understanding is that this happens basically once a year around August. It's funny because we want to call it summer camp, but they're south of the equator, so I don't know if it's considered
winter camp. They don't have four seasons in Kenya, so we want to call it summer camp, but it's just camp. Camp was, many things in this organization were conceived by people who had a passion to do something, and they just did it. And so camp is the brainchild and the actual work product of Tom Gleason and a large team of other people. But it was Tom's idea in the first instance. If it had been left to me, sadly, camp would not exist. And it turns out that camp is the most, it is absolutely the favorite week of the year for every kid in this program. When you ask them what they like about being part of NRCA, they will all lead with camp until they get to be about 20 years old, and then it starts to evolve. But camp is their favorite week of the year for a number of reasons. So you created a good verbal, visual picture of what life is like in the slums. It's hard, it's crowded, it's hot, it's dusty, it's smelly. They have to walk for water every day. They have to, you know, create charcoal or wood fires to cook their food if there's food there. It's a rough daily existence. There's, you know, no improved sanitation. Camp is every year in some beautiful area outside of Nairobi. So these children who never get outside of Nairobi get to leave Nairobi. Kenya has got beautiful national parks and forested areas and mountainous areas, and the kids would not see them if they didn't get to go to camp. So it gets them out of Nairobi. Secondly, they eat three meals a day. It's the only week in the year for sure where they eat three meals a day, which is really a big deal to them. Third, there is wonderful programming, and I think camp has evolved to be this wonderful hybrid between a Kenyan thing and a global thing. We bring a team every year from the United States of 6 to 10 to 12 Americans, and they all bring something to the party. And so the kids get exposed to certainly lots of fun and games, but there also are lots of learning opportunities. So it is a very, very rich experience.
So this happens once a year, and sounds like this year there's some programming that is being brought, and I believe this is the first year this is happening this way, but you can correct me, but there are specifically some different kind of, for lack of better definition, programs. I mean, there's one that's going to be used in the grammar school camp, which is kind of called communication skills. And there's one that's being brought by a professor from Tulane University, who's also, I think she's on the board, if that's right. And I was fortunate enough to meet her on my first trip. She's awesome, Sally Kenny. And it's about lessons from Queen of Katwe. And that's so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how did you kind of open yourself up to going, well, maybe we can do some other things at camp beyond fun and games and beyond the socialization, which sounds like, again, it's been incredibly successful and effective. And I know Tom has put incredible energy into it every year, and it's really remarkable. But then you have these other programs, and how did that come about that you even said, well, let's open this up to beyond hopping around in potato sacks or something?
So Tom is the driver of this, and this kind of programming, this enriched learning programming, has been a feature of camp since its inception. And what Tom does is he invites people who come to share a gift that they have. So we one year had a science teacher who came who devised a competition among students to take balsa wood and some small number paper clips, small number of tools, and they had to compete to see who could make the longest bridge. And so these are things where kids are having fun and learning, but they don't even know that they're learning. Every year there is a film that is featured, and we try to have the film be as relevant to them as we possibly can. This year, having access to Queen of Katwe is powerful because it although it takes place in Uganda, it could take place right where they live. It looks like the slums of Nairobi. And the experiences of this girl who is not allowed to go to school because she has to help her family earn money, because they don't have enough money to eat because the father died. It's the experience that all of these kids have had. And so, you know, I think that framework where there's learning and fun is exactly the framework that we've had since the beginning. Sally Kenny is another great example of someone who had a vision. Her vision was, you know, why don't we get students from Tulane who are interested in international development to come and bring some of their talents to camp? And, you know, getting something like, this is the capstone to a course that is offered in international development. And in this course, they study a wide variety of topics related to, this year the course was taught by a faculty member who will also be at camp by the name of Isabella. So Isabella will be accompanying three of her students. And to get that kind of program through a place like Tulane University, where, you know, you have to get through the risk management process, you have to convince all kinds of layers of people. But this is now the second year that we've had, I think, three students who have both been through the coursework at Tulane and then are coming for this capstone experience. And they'll be making contributions to camp that I'm sure are life transforming for them as well as for the kids. So the other point I'd like to talk about, camp used to just be all the kids together. And then, you know, as we got to have 300 and 350, you just can't have a meaningful camp when you have that large number of students. And so as we started to get some adolescents, Tom conceived the idea that we should have a leadership camp and that students would interview to come to that. So we allow high school age students to interview, and in leadership camp, they are learning both some of the fundamentals of leadership, but they are also learning what duties they have as junior counselors at camp. So all the kids that come to leadership camp will become junior counselors for the rest of camp. And we pay them some small amount of money. I think we pay them $50 at the end of 2 weeks spent having helped us with camp. So they are the first to come, and they learn about leadership principles, but they also learn, if you're on the red team, your duty is to scrape the plates at the end of the night and all the things that we've all experienced when we go to camp. And then, as you said, senior camp is for the high school kids and grammar camp is for the more elementary age kids. The smaller kids, those under age 8, we do not take out of Nairobi. We do a one-day field trip in Nairobi.
So I'm wondering, I have a couple of wrap-up questions. It's like for the last decade, if you think about being a lifelong learner, you've been getting schooled in your own way through running this program and the organization, and you've been getting your PhD in whatever you'd call this. And
international development.
There you go. And and so, you know, usually when you're in a PhD program, you have to complete it with a thesis. And if you were to write a title for your thesis that you would want to write from, and after all of your learning that you've done, I'm wondering if you can envision a title that you would see named on the front cover of your thesis.
One child at a time, probably. I mean, I really think that the way that this, I'd love to have it be something grandiose, like transforming children one at a time, but I really believe they transform themselves, and we are trying to provide the framework and the infrastructure and the support that will allow them to do that, and they have precious little of that in their lives.
Interesting. And another question would be, is there something that comes to mind for you that was kind of an aha or an inspirational moment or one of those moments that maybe kind of brings, you know, kind of just touches your gut over all this time? And maybe there's many of them and it's hard to sort through them, but if whether it was an experience or a memory or a vision or something someone said, you know, is there something that's always stuck with you? And it kind of feels like, yeah, that's it right there. That's still there. And it's kind of, you know, kind of keeps you going because you've been doing this a long time and you've had to keep this organization growing. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything that would sell.
I mean, thank you for asking. There are literally hundreds of those. I mean, the thing that feeds my soul and that keeps me going back for more is the children. And when I get to talk to them and visit their homes and see what's happened in their lives, the thing I do now every year in February or March when I'm there right after the first of the year is I interview all the students who have just finished high school. And by then, they really understand. It's starting to dawn on them that something really good has happened in their lives. They've finished high school, which is not something that the majority of Kenyans have done. And they have the opportunity to do another year or two of school and our support to get a job. And they begin to be aware of how big a deal it is that they've been involved with this program. And so last year when I was talking to kids, I mean, and of course, like all kids, I mean, there are different levels of awareness and self-awareness and communication skills, but I was interviewing this young man named, his name is Wenceslas, but he goes by Wence, and charming, tall, gangly young man. And I asked him the same question I asked all the kids, you know, what have you learned about yourself in the last year or two? And he had good answers for that. And after he told me his answers to that, he just looked at me and he said, why did you do this? It was the first time any child in this program has ever asked me why, what motivated me. And you know, it reflects an awareness and a depth of understanding that kind of took me aback. But I think that that is there now. I mean, when you meet with students who are finishing university or who have gotten jobs, they understand that their lives have been transformed, that they have transformed their own lives, but that we gave them the platform to do that.
That's pretty remarkable. That's really remarkable. And you think about, I just think about when I was in high school and how unenlightened I was. I was like, holy cow.
Well, high school students are famously self-absorbed. And so that a kid would be able to get outside of himself enough to actually, it's the first time it's happened.
That's pretty awesome. Is there anything else that you feel like we didn't cover? Any kind of parting words we can...
We need to do this more.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Paula. It's been a real pleasure. I look forward to following this up with travels to talk with more of the people who are involved with this program, at the camp program. I'll be attending the camp, trying to follow this up with as much possible substance as we had today, because this has been really, really helpful. And we've been sponsors of two kids over the years, and I learned a lot even today. So this has really been a great time. I really appreciate it. It's been my honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
My pleasure.